Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, as the candidates get ready to debate foreign policy tonight, a breakthrough, a possible breakthrough at least, in Iran negotiations might be at hand. Our Planet Money team introduces a fake candidate for president. If actual economists, chose the president in an economy-obsessed year, what would this fake president do? Robert Smith from our Planet Money team will answer that question, plus Gail Collins today on women in the presidential race, and our fall arts preview series turns to the movies. We'll get to David Sanger and the possible breakthrough on Iran negotiations in just a minute. Just give me 60 seconds here to do my duty first and remind you that we are in the home stretch now of our fall membership drive. It ends Wednesday, and if you're just joining us, we're in an all-the-money-in-half-the-time day. So if we can raise $170,000 by noon, the money that would typically be donated for the full day during the drive, you will get Leonard Lopate and the rest of the day fundraiser-free. We're almost on pace to make that goal. Keyword almost. So if you want to support the station anyway, please do it now, and we will make this goal, and we can give you the afternoon off from the pledge drive for when you listen later on. So maybe make a credit card pledge of $5 or $10 a month to help pay the bills while you're listening to the show this hour, and we'll accomplish all the money in half the time today by noon. Thanks a lot for considering it at 1-888-376-WNYC. There's the phone number if you haven't used it yet this drive or this year, 1-888-376-9692, or you can pledge online at WNYC.org, and thanks a lot. Now, David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent, WNYC contributor and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and the Surprising Use of American Power. On tonight's foreign policy debate and the announcement of a possible breakthrough regarding talks on Iran's nuclear program. Hi, David. Welcome back.
Thanks, Brian. Great to be with you.
So the lead story in the Times yesterday, which you contributed to, described an agreement in principle to hold one-on-one talks. Am I right that the U.S. has wanted the one-on-one talks, but Iran has resisted them?
Well, the U.S. has wanted them, and the Iranians have sort of played cat and mouse, although when President Ahmadinejad was in New York for the opening of the United Nations last month, he told reporters, and he said to me during a session he had with some book writers and so forth, that Iran was open to this concept, but only after the election. Then Helene Cooper and Mark Landler poked around some in Washington and discovered, in fact, that there had been sort of an agreement in principle with the U.S. and Iran to do exactly that. Now, the White House issued a very carefully delineated denial on Saturday night when the story was posted, saying that there are no talks scheduled right now, which is absolutely true. There are no talks scheduled. They haven't set a date. And of course, the Iranians are waiting to see what the outcome of the election is, just as we all are. And that would, of course, dramatically affect it. At the same time, the administration then said, of course, we're very open to doing these kind of talks one-on-one. And I think that the allies are a little bit nervous about what would happen if they're not in the room as well. But they consider this a considerable improvement over moving rapidly to military options.
Would Iran be agreeing to this now because they're more afraid of Romney getting elected than Obama getting reelected?
You know, they could be, but the fact of the matter is that since the talks wouldn't happen until after the election, that's really not going to affect it one way or the other. I mean, that if Mr. Romney wins the election, then he's going to be the one to decide whether or not to pursue these talks. And my guess is that he would take a considerable amount of time just getting up and running on the Iranian issue and trying to decide what he wanted to do before he entered talks or participated in any military action. For the Obama administration, if President Obama gets reelected, then I think these could move ahead on a fairly quick timescale. And the U.S. has every incentive to make it happen quickly because, of course, the Iranian strategy could well be just to get the United States into a headlock, draw out negotiations for as long as possible, and, of course, meanwhile, they're producing more uranium fuel.
So why should the U.S. trust this to be something other than that?
They may not be able to trust it to be more than that, and I think many people have suspicions, and I have suspicions that that's all that is there. But let's face it, Brian, if the U.S. and Iran are headed towards some kind of confrontation, military or otherwise, in 2013 or 2014, it would be diplomatic malpractice not to attempt every single possibility to come to a diplomatic solution. And what has not been attempted until now is to see whether the Iranians are more willing to give in now that the sanctions are really taking a bite out of their oil revenues. Remember, this would be the first set of talks of any kind with the U.S. or with any of the allies since those really heavy-duty sanctions went into effect that have cut their revenue, their oil shipments nearly in half.
Has the Romney campaign reacted to this yet? And again, in the context that this has been a U.S. demand or a U.S. request to sit down one-on-one with Iran, and it's been Iran resisting it, if Iran has really agreed in principle now with the Obama administration to one-on-one talks, has the Romney campaign said if they would even sit down with Iran one-on-one? Because I imagine there are people on their right flank saying, no, you don't negotiate with a terrorist regime. You draw a line in the sand.
Well, this is going to be really a more interesting test of who is preeminent in the Romney foreign policy team than anything else. And I'm hoping that while the Romney campaign has said very little about this other than to note the White House denial and not note its second sentence, I'm hoping that this will be a subject of that will come up in tonight's debate, and I have every reason to expect that it will.
Underlying the talks, and my guest is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, and foreign policy what should I call you? A foreign policy wonk, author of
that might be the nicest way to put it. Yeah,
author of Confront and Conceal: Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Underlying the idea of these one-on-one talks, I get the sense that there is actually a framework for a deal on Iran's nuclear program that would allow them to enrich a certain amount of weapons-grade uranium as long as inspectors are allowed regular access to their facilities and they are not actually building a bomb. Is that a distinction that Iran is trying to make, enriching the uranium but not building a bomb?
That is certainly the essence of the American proposal that was made to Iran back in the spring.
American proposal.
Right, an American proposal. And it basically went like this. It was Iran gives up its enrichment of the medium-enriched uranium, the stuff that's closest to bomb grade, that it ships all of that out of the country, that it continues to produce a limited amount of the low-enriched fuel would take a lot longer to get to a bomb, and that meanwhile the two countries would then begin to negotiate on ways that the U.S. and other countries could provide it with reactor fuel that would allow a civilian program but not a nuclear program. Now, a nuclear weapons program. The Iranians came back in the summer with a proposal of their own, which basically was the mirror image of this. It was, okay, you guys stop all of the sanctions on us immediately. Then you go through the following 9 steps, and I won't bore you with each and every one of them. And at the end of it, we suspend the production of the most enriched fuel, but we don't ship it out of the country. And the U.S. looked at it and said, forget it. We give up all our leverage at the beginning. You give up very little at the end. So the obvious compromise here goes in some way of staging this so that as the U.S. begins to lift a few sanctions, the Iranians stop the production that the U.S. And others are most worried about and the Israelis are most worried about. But whether they can get to that, we don't know. And remember, we're not the only ones having an election. The Iranians have a presidential election next June. And there are going to be hardliners there arguing for not giving in a thing to the U.S.
And at the same time, their economy has been taking such hits from the sanctions and I think also from internal mismanagement that it's put a lot of pressure on Ahmadinejad to make such a deal in the year before he runs for president. So they've got underlying economic issues pushing foreign policy issues, too.
They do, although it's not Ahmadinejad making the decision here. First, he can't run again. He's term limited, but his people can. The second is we think all the decision-making here is being made by the supreme leader, and Ayatollah Khamenei. And Ahmadinejad and Khamenei have not gotten along terribly well in the past few years. You may remember that in 2009, there was a deal that was negotiated that would have actually prevented a lot of what's happened in the past 2 years. There was a long negotiating session in Vienna. I was there covering it. Everybody held a nice press conference. They announced a deal. The Iranians went back to Tehran, and the Supreme Leader killed the entire deal. So it never happened. And so one of the big questions here is, what has the Supreme Leader actually allowed to happen here? Or is he just biding his time, allowing negotiations to go on, and he figures he'll just evaluate what they come back with?
You know, one of the things that I noticed in the article yesterday in the Times was that it quoted Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, saying Israel had not been informed of any agreement in principle for one-on-one talks between the U.S. and Iran. I would expect Romney to make an issue of that at the debate tonight. Why wouldn't Obama's folks have told Israel, rather than, I guess, you all at the Times telling Israel what Obama was doing with Iran?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. And my guess is that it's a question of how formal, this is guesswork, how formal this understanding was. Do I think there's anything on paper? No. Do I think that there is an understanding among the lead negotiators here that they're all going to get back together right after the election? This is assuming that President Obama wins, and thus there's an agreement that the Obama team can actually execute on. Yeah, I think that's what's probably going on here. Now, the Israelis themselves have made it pretty clear that they are in favor of a discussion taking place between the U.S. and Iran, as long as it's a fairly rapid one. In other words, they recognize there needs to be additional diplomacy here, but they are more fearful than anyone of this dragging out, because it would be very difficult for them to take military action or even threaten military action while there are active talks underway. That may be exactly why the Iranians are willing to talk.
On Israel more generally and the politics of tonight's debate, I would guess that Israel might be a central Romney talking point tonight, because who can he win over in the crucial swing states with a foreign policy debate? I mean, we have to take this, I think, out of the realm of, oh, people like you and me are interested in foreign policy, Syria and China and Latin America and all these things, and think, oh, there's an election in 15 days. Who are they trying to appeal to? And for Romney, maybe it's people from the large Jewish retiree population in Florida as much as anyone, not the waitress moms in Ohio who are going to care about foreign policy, maybe another swing constituency. So he'll go Israel, 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 Cuba tonight. Do you think?
Could well, and both are at an interesting turning point here. So Israel has been sort of a lodestar for Governor Romney, and he has accused President Obama of allowing too much daylight between the U.S. and Israeli policy. Now, President Obama would argue, I think, that while the two countries are extremely close allies and have cooperated very hard on intelligence, we've discussed previously, they jointly developed the cyber weapon that was used against the Iranian nuclear program. They, of course, are doing military exercises right now jointly in the Persian Gulf. The difference between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu has been that the Prime Minister has wanted to make the case for sort of an automatic attack if the Iranians get beyond a certain point in their nuclear development. And President Obama, frankly, doesn't think that's in Israel's interest or the United States' interest. And I think the thing to look for tonight is whether President Obama can, on the one hand, say, I'm Israel's greatest friend, and on the other hand, say, a wise friend doesn't allow another country to take actions that might be against its long-term interest.
Last thing, we have about a minute left, and back to Iran. Why should people be so concerned about Iran getting a nuclear weapon that it becomes the central organizing principle of American foreign policy? Skeptics about being hawks on this say, look, even if Iran develops a nuclear weapon, it would never, ever use it against Israel or anybody else, because that would assure the destruction of whatever Iranian regime was in power. The entire world would come and get them if they ever actually dropped a nuclear bomb on anybody. Therefore, the whole thing is, you know, something they would have in storage and they would have bragging rights, and so what?
Two answers to that, Brian. The first is that if Iran had a weapon, or more likely, if they just had a virtual weapon, which is to say the capability to build one fairly quickly, it would increase their negotiating capability within the Middle East. And it would probably prompt other big players in the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia, first among them, but maybe Egypt and the UAE, to get a weapon themselves. So you would suddenly have the most hotly contested corner of the earth become highly nuclearized. That's a prescription for trouble. The second is that while everybody thinks conventional deterrence would work against an Iranian missile attack, say on Israel or American forces in the Middle East, the big concern here is the weapon or material that slipped to a terror group, Hezbollah, Hamas, whatever, gets set off in a cargo shipment or in a backpack or whatever, and is very difficult to trace back to Iran. And so it's the hard-to-attribute attack versus the overt attack that we would think of in Cold War terms that's the big worry.
And we leave it there with David Sanger, WNYC contributor, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, and author of the book Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David, very interesting. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
And listeners, once again, tonight I'll be holding a pre-debate call-in at 8 o'clock for WNYC listeners and callers from swing state public radio stations. And during the debate, we'll have a live chat and debate bingo at our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Coming up next, our Planet Money team introduces a fake candidate for president. Stay with us for The Real Reasons Why.